Thought Leadership from PwC.
Welcome to PwC's Accounting Podcast. I'm Heather Horn. Thanks for joining me for a special podcast episode on the deals market for 2023. Think acquisitions, divestitures, capital raising, capital restructuring, and other financial engineering and risk management. Where is it headed in 2023? And what does that mean for business?
People are getting ready, right? So those companies that understand that we're in a recession, we're in a time of uncertainty, and so there's certain things I can't close in a deal. It doesn't mean I can't be preparing for the deal activity that I need.
That's my guest, Chris Rhodes, a partner in PwC's deals practice who focuses on structuring, valuation, and accounting for deals. Chris is here to provide a deals market outlook in this high volatility environment. In addition, I've asked Andreas Ohl, frequent podcast guest and valuation specialist, to pop in here and there to provide some perspective on the related accounting. We have a lot to cover, so let's get started. So Chris, welcome back to the podcast. So nice to have you on as we start to look ahead to 2023. And hopefully people are most of the way through their close and starting to look ahead. So we thought it'd be a great time to have an update on the deals market for 2023, which I've said like four times. So what can you share with us as a starting point?
Well, first, I would say thank you for having me. In terms of what we're seeing, if I were to compare this to what you would have gotten from me, say, a month ago, it would have been a little more, I think the two words I would use are pessimism and uncertainty. Pessimism is not a problem to doing deals. Uncertainty is a problem to doing deals. And in the last 3 or 4 weeks, some of that uncertainty has waned. So, but if we look back, we'll do a brief history, look in the rearview mirror. If we look back at calendar 22, I think, you know, we saw the second half of the year just have a really sharp decline in all deal-making activity. But 2022 as a total year was a significant decline from an excessive peak, right? And so 2022 in total is still a very active year. And it's kind of on par with like 2015 through 2019, so like just pre-COVID, sort of that moving average. So 2022, if anything, is sort of a reversion to the norm. But we felt it as a big decline because we were just all so busy in 2021 mm-hmm. and the first part of 22. So I'd say that big theme is a significant decline, but possibly viewed optimistically as back to normal, right? I think we expect it to kick back up. I don't think the post-COVID realignment of things is going to stop. I think mostly the markets got really uncertain. So two big themes we'll talk about in a minute, but the debt markets got really uncertain and remain very difficult, but are relaxing, and I'll get to that in a minute. And then the equity markets have been significantly down, so and pretty volatile, but that's relaxing, and I'll get to that in a second. In terms of 2022, we saw sort of the end of the SPAC boom. I think we see pretty significant, you know, recession expectations, and those have also relaxed. So I would say over the last 3 or 4 weeks, let's look at those three things, right? A lot of bank earnings statements came out. A lot of the banks are forecasting a much shallower recession, which is nice, sort of helps in terms of the forecast. Number two, the interest rate and inflation environment is relaxing. We've had a few months in a row of, I wouldn't call it great news for inflation, but much more stabilizing news for inflation. I think the Federal Reserve and interest rates is taking a posture that's much more understandable by the debt markets. And in January activity, you're seeing the high yield debt markets show a big increase in volume relative to what I would flippantly characterize as basically closed debt markets. So I think PwC's publicly stated view is a significant recovery to deal activity end of Q2, early Q3, so midway through 2023. I'll pause there and say the overall theme is between pessimism and instability. The instability is waning and it's becoming fairly stable. And the pessimism, while still moderately negative, is less scary.
It's an interesting point. I want to come back to some of the individual points you made, but I want to dwell for a moment on pessimism, which is perhaps not a great thing to dwell on, but it's sort of a spoiler alert for our listeners. I recorded a podcast with Bhushan Sethi, who is working in our Fit for Growth practice. And he is going to be our Thursday episode this week, talking about many different things, including the results of the CEO survey. And one of the themes we discussed is the fact that this is the most pessimistic that CEOs have been, it's, you know, in quite some time. I don't know if he says the whole time we've been doing the survey, but definitely a strong note of pessimism. So it sounds like you are seeing that reflected in the deals market, but perhaps unlike what Bhushan and I talked about, because we were talking more broadly, you're thinking that perhaps from a deals perspective, we may start to see some turnaround to that in the later part of this year, potentially?
Correct. A good way of saying that is between pessimism and uncertainty is it's difficult to do a deal when everything's uncertain. But if it's steady pessimism, you can adapt for that. So one way to think of that is if you're sailing a boat, if the headwinds are challenging, but they're constantly at the same speed, you can adapt for that. When the winds are changing constantly, it's harder to sail the boat. So I can handle a steady and predictable headwind.
All right. That's a very good analogy there. So then let's go back to what you were talking about. And you made this easy for me to ask follow-up questions because you said debt markets are doing X, equity markets are doing Y. So it's like, okay, those are the two main markets. So fairly easy to ask those questions. But why don't we start with sort of the influence of the debt markets, and then we can get into the equity markets and some of the other factors that you talked about.
Right. So in the current state of things, we just did a deals outlook webcast, and in there, some of our deals professionals highlighted a couple of corporate sectors that are still really active in the deal market, and the proportion of deals going to corporates and away from private equity is evidenced by the fact that there's a lot of corporates that have some cash on hand, so they don't need the debt markets to do their deals, and they can therefore do their deals. Whereas when the debt markets are unstable or closed or inaccessible at good prices or reasonable prices, the private equity bidders are out of the deal, right? And that's evidenced by a number of private equity deals signed and announced midway through 22 that spent all the second half of 22 desperately delaying, holding on, and hoping and trying to get debt financing. And as the high yield debt market kicks up with notable activity in January, to me, that seems like debt markets reopening. And that means more bidders, more competition, and more ability to do deals, which means all that pent-up demand. It's not like companies don't want to chop and change their portfolio, right? Companies want to sell. Buyers want to buy. They just couldn't finance the deals. And so that gave a big advantage to the corporate buyers with the available cash. But with the debt markets closed, it cuts out a lot of bidders, right? And so now that the debt markets are coming back, whether you can attribute that to whatever you want, I would never want to sound like the guy that belongs on CNBC talking about the debt markets or give investment advice. But my personal observation is for whatever motivators and whatever drivers are behind it, I personally think it's, you know, it's inflation and a steadier communication strategy from the Fed. The debt markets are reopening.
Then you said equity markets. So what's the counterbalance from that?
So the equity markets were gyrating up and down, especially in tech. And, you know, I think our tech leader on the recent webcast described it as falling off a cliff in terms of deal activity, which it did, the tech sector in particular. But all of that was going on, and you saw the tech sector really hit in the equity markets. But I always look at the VIX, so that's the volatility index, and that's just, you know, any investor can have any view about what the right price of something is or whether they should divest of something. But in general, how choppy is the market? And the VIX really spiked there for a while, and it's been coming down, and it's below that threshold line of 20%. So to me, what that says is while the equity markets might be lower, again, stability. I can handle a stable lower price. In fact, very oddly, that helps deal activity, right? Every deal maker looks at an available public comp that's lower, and they feel like they're holding a 20% off coupon. Makes it easy to go shopping. So with a more stable or more consistently stable equity market, which is our hope, then deals can start to get done as well there.
So, Chris, if we think more broadly about sort of macroeconomic, even geopolitical factors, one of the other things Bhushan and I were talking about, you mentioned tech sector, and we were talking about all the layoffs we've seen in the tech sector, and obviously very human toll to those layoffs. And I don't want to discount that. But if we're just thinking about from a deal perspective, what is that signal, if anything, or is it just two completely separate sort of set of factors?
Fair question. That could lead us down a very complicated, esoteric rabbit hole. The way I will carefully sidestep it is to say that generally speaking, the labor market remains tight, right? So all these other pessimistic indicators like down equity markets, closed debt markets, inflation, higher VIX, uncertainty at the Fed, all those things that were going on for so many months, the labor market was still tight. There's still great labor statistics. So while there might be big layoffs at tech, tech generally has, I'll call it a quicker turnaround time for frictional unemployment, right? So tech professionals, very, you know, I don't want to be too casual with this statement, but tech professionals tend to find another job, right? Mm-hmm. And so, and that's because on a macro basis, it's a tight labor market, right? And so I think the fact that labor remains generally fully employed, all these other pessimistic challenges are manageable if they stabilize, right? That stable headwind analogy.
All right. Well, I know there's some other factors we might want to talk about. I just want to make sure we've hit them all. So anything, inflation, you mentioned yield curve, but anything we want to dig more into that? Or are we want to kind of talk about some of the broader headwinds we're seeing from a macroeconomic geopolitical perspective?
I think what I would say is two things. One is I forgot to mention that you know, despite all these things stabilizing, there is one negative indicator that I always look at, and that's the shape of the yield curve. And right now, the 10-year Treasury continues to be down, so we have a very clearly inverted yield curve. And generally speaking, that's not good for business, right? So under my thesis that stability is more valuable than pessimism or can overcome pessimism, perhaps a stable but inverted yield curve can be managed. But generally speaking, and there's a whole host of reasons why that, you know, why it's the case, that's usually not a good thing, right? That's the market predicting declines in the future. But if that inverted yield curve is meant to imply that, you know, the Fed will eventually stabilize short-term rates and come down to meet that 10-year treasury, and we'll have a nice stable flat or slightly upward sloping correctly shaped yield curve in the medium term, and we all believe in that thesis and we all, you know, believe in the stability of that, then again, I think my sort of broader thesis of pessimism isn't terrible as long as it's predictable, understandable, and stable.
All right. It's a very interesting perspective. Let me ask you one more broad question. And then to your point, let's get into some accounting. But just curious, listening to you talk about these sort of broad trends and what this means broadly from a deals market, what does that mean for an individual deal? So an individual buyer looking at an individual company, does this really matter, or does it come down? And in the, sorry, let me ask it a different way. Am I really just looking at my deal economics, or am I considering all of these factors when I'm thinking about if I want to do this particular deal?
Little of both. So usually, let's go outside of opportunistic private equity, price arbitrage, and go corporate strategy, right? Okay. I'm a company that wants to acquire a bit of complementary technology that will enhance my business and strategically shift my company into a new space, right? It'll open a new market for me. It has non-cash flow strategic value, synergy value for me, right? I want to do this, but I need to borrow a little money to do it, and I need to agree a price with my counterparty. It's hard to agree a price with my counterparty when the public market comps are all over the place. And it's hard to agree a price with my counterparty when I don't know how much debt versus equity I got to finance the deal. So while I've arrived at the strategic realization that I need this technology and I want to add it to my business and I want to go in a strategic direction, I still have to negotiate, execute, and price the deal. And I owe it to my shareholders to realize more value for me and my shareholders than I paid for it. And when I can't figure out what I need to pay for it, then I really need to look at the combination of the strategic value versus the pure financial value of the deal.
All right. So, Chris, I'm going to interrupt you for a moment because, as I previewed in the beginning of the podcast, I actually have a special guest I asked to just pop in and give us some accounting consideration. So welcome, Andreas, for your special guest appearance. And just a question for you, and then we can see how much we want to dive into this. But listening to Chris and talking about some of the deal environment right now, things are different. And what does that mean from an accounting perspective? And how does that translate to someone who's in financial reporting, and particularly as they thought about past deals or deals in the future?
Yeah, so anytime you see a downturn in the economy, or in particular a downturn in the deal market, it makes you think about, well, what about the deals that have been done in the past that are already in the books and records, and do I potentially have some impairments there, right? So that's question number one that comes up. And so maybe I'll start with just a little bit of context. So I think we're not in 2008 where like models stopped working because there was no liquidity in the market and things like that. So I think people shouldn't be overly concerned like we were when we were back then. And remembering just that while the market is down, right, the market is down to levels where it was in, you know, like early 2021, right? So basically what we've done is undone the big rally in 2021. And while some tech stocks are down a lot, the market overall is down 20, which means that there are companies whose stocks have traded up, and there's a lot that maybe haven't moved all that much. So you always have to understand the context of what industry you're in and what's happening with your specific company. So maybe with that, then I think there's like a bunch of broad themes, right? There's interest rates, there's inflation, there's control premiums that come up, and then maybe there's some other minor things that will come up along the way. So if I start with interest rates, let me tell you a story.
All right.
So when I went to business school, which is a while ago, the first case that we did in the sort of the baby finance class was looking at the acquisition of Gulf Oil in 1985. And that was a $15 billion transaction, so it was a very large transaction. You know, in today's dollars, I don't know what that is, $50 billion or something like that. So a large transaction. So the question for you, since you always ask the questions, I'm going to ask you a question. What was the cost of capital in that transaction?
So early 80s, I'm going to guess maybe 18%, 20%, some
very
high inflation.
Very good, 20%.
Oh, wow, that's
very
a lucky
good.
Guess.
I did not bring any prizes with me today. So why do I illustrate that? Well, why was the cost of capital 20%? Well, the risk-free rate, so the 10-year treasury, was over 11% in 1985. Today, it's 3.5%. So a really large transformational transaction happened when the cost of capital interest rates were dramatically higher than they are today. So I think Chris was right when he was talking about, you know, it's not so much the level, it's the degree of uncertainty. And as the uncertainty starting to come out, things will calm down a little bit. But I think the point is you can still run cash flow models when the risk-free rate is 3.5%. We've dealt with much worse in our time.
All right. Although to be fair, most of our audience, I doubt, was born, and even our audience that was born was probably not working then. But let me ask you a question, because to me, the first thing that comes to mind is impairment. So now I did a deal when the interest rates weren't at this level, even if they're not at, 11% risk-free rate. So now how do I think about changes in rates, inflation, some of these other things you've talked about as I look at impairment of past deals?
Well, there's always two parts to the calculation, right? There's the cash flows, and then there's the discount rate. So certainly for most companies, the discount rate is higher. And so if you did an acquisition in the middle of or in late 2021 when conditions were different, and all you do is change the discount rate, you probably have an impairment if that acquisition wasn't folded into a larger reporting unit where there might be some shielding, which is often what happens. But that's not the entire story, right? You also have to look at the cash flow side of the equation, and that's maybe where you bring in the second theme of inflation. And many companies have been able, certainly public companies have been able to deal with inflation to a large degree where they've been able to pass on the higher costs. And you saw that many companies in the first three quarters of the year had record profits, right? Which means that the cash flow side of the equation also went up. It's not just that the discount rate went up, the cash flow side went up,
as well. Andreas, not to interrupt, but I can't help myself. That means their costs probably also went up. So then as I'm thinking about it, my bottom line number may not have gone up as much as maybe my revenue would have indicated. So there's lots of factors there.
Yeah, so certainly, but I think net, most companies were able to raise prices faster than their costs were going up. So you saw margin expansion in the first part of the year. Now in the fourth quarter, now we're only in the early stages of earnings season, but right now it's trending towards that S&P earnings are actually going to be down in the fourth quarter, which is the first time that's happened since the early days of the COVID lockdown, which obviously distorted a lot of things for a period of time. But my point just being that when you're doing a impairment model, you generally are doing a cash flow model, is what most people are doing. And you have to think about both sides of the equation. So just because your discount rate changed doesn't automatically trigger an impairment. You really need to think about, well, what was the effect on my industry? And what was the effect on my cash flows? If I'm still successfully passing costs along, then my cash flow may actually be higher than what I thought it would be back when I did the deal. Now, whatever you calculate, obviously, if you're a public company, certainly has to be, you have to be able to reconcile that back to the market. So, you know, you can have a great cash flow model that says this deal is now worth twice as much as when I did the deal 2 years ago. But if your stock price is down 50%, those two things might be difficult to reconcile. Now, the way people typically reconcile discrepancies between, you know, the calculated value and the market indicator of value, right? So the market capitalization of the company is with something called a control premium, right? Where the premise is that the publicly quoted stock price, that's a, you know, this individual shares times the number of shares outstanding. So it's a minority position. Whereas when I buy a company, I'm buying a controlling position and I pay more for a controlling position because I get to make decisions that in theory allow me to create value that I can't do if I'm an individual shareholder. And so the question though is well, what's the right control premium? And does that control premium change depending upon where you are in the business cycle? And this is one thing you always have to be careful with, which is when the M&A market turns, the deals that tend to get done are the best deals. And so sometimes you'll observe that control premiums get larger in a down market, but that doesn't necessarily mean people are willing to pay a premium for your business. They're just willing to pay a sizable premium for a deal that really makes a lot of sense. Or said differently, if a target company's stock price is down because of general market conditions, if I want to buy that company and I have a really good value creation proposition, I probably have to pay a substantial premium to convince that target company to sell. And that's why you often observe higher control premiums in a down market. That doesn't mean that applies across the board to other people's impairment tests. You always still have to think about, well, why would somebody pay a premium for this business? And if they did, how much would it be? And that how much would it be would be a function of how much value can a hypothetical acquirer create.
So Andreas, you know, one of the themes we've had over the past couple of months on the podcast is that with all the changes, and I'll say the world simplistically, that you can't just carry forward financial reporting. You can't just carry forward your management's discussion. And I think this is another really good case, whether you're talking about year end or looking ahead to Q1, that you really need to look at your unique circumstances of the business you acquired, your consolidated business, what's going on more broadly in your industry and otherwise to reach this conclusion. And there really truly isn't a one size fits all. And you can't just look at what you've done necessarily in the past because there's probably changes that need to be made.
Yeah, a good example of that is maybe the next thing I'll highlight, which so Chris talked about how because of the debt markets being shut down, that private equity had largely exited the M&A market, that it was mostly a corporate market right now. Well, so one of the implications of that is when you think about fair valuing a business for purposes of the impairment test, you have to think about who are the market participants, i.e. who are the likely buyers of that business. And if you were in a position a year ago when you did your last test that you had concluded, well, the likely buyers are private equity buyers for whatever reason, and there's various reasons why you might think private equity is more likely to be an acquirer for a particular business than a corporate. If you look at it with today's market conditions, you may have to think differently, because remember, fair value is as of the measurement date. And so it's quite possible that your pool of market participants is not the same as it was last year. That may lead to a different value, but it may also, if you go back to like the control premium, where the way you justify control premium is, I'm willing to pay a premium for your business because I can achieve generally these synergies, and I'm going to give some portion of that to the seller. That's basically the control premium, right? Generally, PE acquirers and corporate acquirers have fundamentally different paths to creating value, right? Like a PE generally doesn't have synergies unless they're merging the target in with another portfolio company they already own. They're generally trying to achieve value through other means, like maybe fundamentally changing something in the business that a corporate wouldn't do is their path to value creation, whereas the corporate has a different path. And so now you say, well, if I change market participants, I may have to rethink how I'm thinking about my control premium as well. So I think that's a great example of, as the world moves, it's not a static model where you just say, okay, well, here's my impairment model. Let me take out, add this year's budget and take out last year's budget and adjust the discount rate mechanically, and off I go.
So, Andreas, let me ask you a question then on these control premiums, because as you started talking about it, I was thinking, oh, automatically there's going to be a higher control premium with private equity, more funds, whatever else. I don't know, just maybe a bias. However, if I really step back, that's not necessarily the case, because if I'm a corporate, depending on the business, I maybe would have more synergy. I might be willing to pay more to get the market share or otherwise. So I don't, again, this is, there's not an obvious answer here. You really have to look at your individual circumstances. Is that a fair conclusion?
Yeah, that's right. I don't think I've ever seen a study that says PE buyers pay larger premiums or corporates pay larger premiums. It's really a function of premiums are driven by generally what kind of value do I as an acquirer think I can create by buying this business? And then depending upon the competitive dynamics, i.e. how many other bidders are, will generally dictate how much of that value I'm going to create. Do I have to pay the seller to get them to play along with the transaction?
All right. So let me ask you one more question, and then I'll go back to Chris and talk a little bit more looking ahead. But sort of on that note of looking ahead, is there anything either with past deals that companies should stay focused on in 2023, or anything that is they're thinking about a deal that they may want to focus on from an accounting perspective?
Well, in terms of past deals, you know, and this actually is, we talk about standard setting a lot on these podcasts. And so, you know, there's this idea that the ISB is working on around enhanced disclosures about why did you do the transaction and what are the key metrics that you're going to use to assess whether the transaction is sort of like on target to perform as you wanted it to be. So that would certainly be something that companies might want to think about, both for past deals, recent past deals, and new deals, to maybe be a little bit more explicit about the pathways to value, how you're going to measure whether you're on track, who's responsible for it, so that you get the execution as right as you can. Because, you know, deals go sideways for a whole bunch of reasons. Generally, it's not because of market conditions. It's generally because of something on either the execution side, or maybe there were just fundamentally bad assumptions in the model that you thought something was much more doable than it really was. And there was actually a good reason the target company didn't fix that themselves, that it was either really hard to fix or would be really costly to fix. So that's how I might think about it.
All right. Very helpful, Andreas. Thank you for your guest appearance. And Chris, let me go back to you to talk a little bit more about what we expect to see as we look ahead in 2023.
We just did a deals outlook webcast. There were sort of two points about divestitures as being underappreciated in terms of shareholder value. The first is that 50% of Fortune 500 companies did or plan to do an acquisition. And then I'm going to get these stats slightly wrong, but 20% did a divestiture. Like, is there a bias against divestitures? And what they did is they went and partnered with an academic study that proved that, yes, there's sort of a psychological bias against divestitures. And then oddly, a separate analysis showed, and I read this somewhere else, so I'm just pulling a bunch of pieces together, but a separate analysis showed that the seller generally gets the better end of a deal. Now, I like to flippantly dismiss that as the winner's curse, right? The winner of any bid had to slightly overpay relative to the other bidders, right? So if the winner's curse means that the buyers generally pay up, well, the seller's that mechanism is generally biased towards the seller getting a better end of the deal. So why are divestitures not more popular? And I can tell you for sure, based on where I'm spending all my time, that divestitures are popular and the smart money is actively looking at monetizing any sort of asset that is worth more in the hands of somebody else than it is with them. And they are, companies are now being able to objectively self-assess and say, look, I run this business really well, but if you look at this segment, somebody else could do it better. And somebody's willing to pay me more than I'm going to get from holding and operating this business, it's okay for me to let it go. But that psychological bias is people mistakenly view that as a failure of leadership in some kind of way, right? I didn't extract the maximum value for this thing. Well, hey, you know, maybe it just didn't go really well there, right? Maybe
it's synergy. Come on, Chris. Yeah. Everything is because of synergy.
Everything is because of synergies. I agree with you on that. So that's the other one. Divestitures. The big takeaway there is if you do a deep dive on divestitures, they are extremely, extremely relevant to unlocking shareholder value, and people are coming around to that. And that's reflected both in just what I have to spend my days doing. I'm working a lot more on carve outs and divestitures. And then that releases all the divestiture, discontinued operation, standalone financial statements, standalone audits, you know, SEC filing requirements for a divestiture and things like that. So there's a whole rabbit hole. We could do a whole podcast on just the SEC reporting around a divestiture. So I will stop there. But I think, you know, when debt markets are closed, it's a really, really easy access to cash.
All right. So that's good. And definitely always good to have ideas for follow-up podcasts. All right. One more theme here on the challenges. And this is around value creation. I mentioned this earlier. And I think you may have hit on some of these, but anything specific you want to call out in terms of what companies are kind of doing in response to what we're seeing more broadly in the market?
Right. So obviously in a steady headwind, you've got to be a little bit more clever with how you operate the boat, right? So I'm definitely seeing, again, it's they all go together, right? But you could almost repeat all the things here around clever financing, right? Mezzanine financing, definitely sale leasebacks. I'm seeing a lot of companies look at optimizing their real estate, right? There is definitely capitalization, right? There's CapEx. If I have the money, but I can't get an acquisition done, well, I'm going to have to build it. So there's a lot of CapEx and there's a lot of capitalization, especially capitalization of software. So there's a lot of software capitalization debates, a lot of sale leasebacks. I'll call it a lot of, I'll badly call it hardware or CapEx as a service. So instead of acquiring all of that asset, there's a lot of as a service business models coming in and looking at your operating expenses and how much you want to buy by the drink versus own for yourself, right? So there's a, I'll call that consistent with our firm's clear and repeated vocabulary around and position around the broader cloud transformation, digital transformation, cloud transition type themes. But I'm definitely seeing that in the accounting. And then lastly, analytics, analytics, analytics. I've been doing great with all my customers, but if I just get a better pile of data and I really parse that data and I run it through just a really great analytical black box, it's going to produce a magical amount of organic value that I've always been sitting on. I can just go realize it now. I just have to dig it out with the data mining, right? So this belief that data mining is going to release a lot of value kind of proves true. When people are really digging into the data, they find a lot of stuff they just weren't seeing, and they don't have to go acquire a business and they don't have to go borrow a bunch of money. They could just do what they're doing a lot more efficiently. So I would say that efficiency transformation is like, hey, if I can't buy a thing and I can't be running around buying, you know, shiny new toys, I can run what I have way, way better. And they've been doing that.
Well, even here at the podcast, we're a fan of analytics. I wouldn't say that we are maybe getting more efficient, but when you look at your data a different way, it does give you different ideas about things you should be doing. So I definitely can see that even myself in looking at like listener data or otherwise. So Chris, we've been really focused here on challenges, but
you know, the flip side of a challenge is an opportunity. So hopefully, I don't know if they're equal and opposite here, but definitely if they're challenges for some, that means there are opportunities for others, or maybe even those same entities. So what are some of the opportunities you're seeing, particularly maybe given uncertainty or otherwise?
Right. So probably two things that are easy to say. One is, in this opportunity of opportune moment of uncertainty, look, the flip side of reward is risk. If you're willing to make a big bet when everything's uncertain, you might get there way, way first. So that's the game theory, right? Do I take a risk and go first? How much first mover advantage is there in this? If I go back to my very simplified example of I'm a corporate, I have a strategic need to go to an adjacent technology. I'm not going to build it myself. I'm going to go acquire it. I see my target. Oh my gosh, the VIX is way high and I'm not sure about equity values and I can't borrow the money to do it. If I just say, forget it, I need it and I'm going to go first and I'm going to get there now while it's uncertain, then you're ready for the upturn in the market, right? And so the other thing is the being ready. So the first thing is, I mean, how much does fortune favor the bold and how much of that is irresponsible use of shareholder money, right? So thankfully, I'm a consultant explicitly for not having to make that choice as any kind of CEO, right? And then the second piece is being ready. And this, I think, is where we see it the most. People are getting ready, right? So those companies that understand that we're in a recession, we're in a time of uncertainty, and so there's certain things I can't close in a deal, it doesn't mean I can't be preparing for the deal activity that I need. So I'm doing all the things that I can do without available debt markets to close a deal and without a clearly available comp set in the public markets, but I can be getting ready. So whether it means I'm getting ready to sell a business because I'm working on a lot of carve-outs, whether I'm getting ready to take a part of my business public or take the whole business public, and I recognize that there haven't been any IPOs for quite a while or not a very low volume of IPOs. So, okay, fine. My strategy is no longer to sell it to a SPAC in a hot SPAC market. I still need to be ready to go public and I'm still working on it, right? So the being ready is kind of the big theme we've seen. So I would say what I see in these opportunities is the game theory of I'm going to be ready when a stable situation or an opportunity arises. So, and therefore, if you've been getting ready, you're going to reap those rewards because you'll be ready to move.
So Chris, as always, such a pleasure to have you on. And I guess I can book you now for the end of July of 2023. So thanks for joining me.
Thank you. I look forward to it.
That's our show for today. Tune in next week for more fresh episodes. So that you never miss any of our audio content, follow the PwC Accounting Podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. And to stay up to date on all our latest accounting and reporting news, sign up for our newsletter at viewpoint.pwc.com. From thought leadership at PwC, I'm Heather Horn. Thanks for tuning in.
This podcast is brought to you by PwC, all rights reserved. PwC refers to the U.S. member firm or one of its subsidiaries or affiliates, and they sometimes refer to the PwC network. Each member firm is a separate legal entity. Please see www.pwc.com/structure for further details. This podcast is for general information purposes only and should not be used as a substitute for consultation with professional advisors.